Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Oncology Grand Rounds, as today we talk about one of the most exciting developments in the history of medical oncology, the use of CAR T therapy. But let's talk about CAR T therapy, and maybe we can bring up the slides here. Here's where we're heading here tonight. We have people from various backgrounds here tonight. The CAR T therapy is used in different kinds of cancers. So we're going to start out talking about CAR T in general, how it works, particularly what the side effects and toxicities are. And then we're going to explore where currently it's fitting in with three diseases, multiple myeloma, diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and ALL, acute lymphoblastic leukemia. We'll just briefly talk about sort of where it fits in each spot. But I want to kind of begin and just kind of provide a little bit of an overview. And Krishna, you know, we've had the idea of immunity and anti-cancer therapy for a long time. We've used allogeneic transplant. We have checkpoint inhibitors. We have vaccines. Can you talk a little bit of sort of about the history of immunology and cancer immunology and how that sort of led to the thinking that led to CAR T?
Yeah, it's fascinating. So allogeneic CAR T cells, allogeneic transplantation was first successfully done in 1968. And what's amazing is, you know, we think about B cells, what they do, and T cells, obviously, like CAR T cells. We actually didn't know until 1968 that B cells and T cells were different subsets of cells. So the allogeneic transplant era actually started in the 1950s. We started curing people in the late 1960s. We actually didn't know what a T cell was. And we really didn't know much about the biology of T cells till 10 to 15 years after we were reliably curing patients with allogeneic transplant. And that's actually interesting because we actually thought that what was curing patients with allogeneic transplant was super high doses of chemotherapy and radiation. And it wasn't until the mid-1980s to 1990 when people started doing transplants, taking out the T cells, thinking that, well, that'll prevent the donor cells from attacking the recipient, causing what we call graft versus host disease. And by doing that, we did decrease graft versus host disease, but we found that relapses doubled. So that really told us that, hey, wait a minute, T cells, you know, are not just passengers in an allogeneic transplant, but actually can cure cancer. And then fast forwarding now, you know, we have these amazing ways of either taking the brakes off T cells with CAR T cell, with checkpoint inhibitors, or genetically manipulating T cells and expanding them outside the body, which is what we're talking about today. So really great story. And as an immunologist who does laboratory research, it's amazing how little we knew about the power of T cells and how recently, you know, we've really recognized how important a modality this is.
Nikhil, I'm curious how you explain sort of how cancer immunology works and what the body's normal defense mechanisms are that are involved with cancer.
There was a whole algorithm developed what is required for cancer to develop. And an important component of that is lack of immune response, because while the cancer is developing, the body recognizes those developing tumor cells as foreign and tries to fight it. And in the process of development of cancer, there are different changes that takes place and which are induced mostly by the cancer cells themselves, which prevents the immune cells from doing what they're supposed to do. So in an actively growing cancer, the immune system is prevented from doing the function. And so then when we want the immune cells to do something, we have to do two things. One is to get rid of those inhibitory mechanisms, which cancer has, that doesn't let the T cell function. And on the other hand, allow the T cell now to be able to recognize cancer as the enemy and try and fight it and kill it. In doing so, also make its own growth. So this balance between the two causes cancer. And as we will discuss today, the ability to overcome this change that has happened to even conquer the cancer in a very positive way.
So Bettina, I'm curious how you explain to patients sort of what CAR T therapy is and how it's actually done. Can you maybe just talk a little bit about, particularly about sort of the basis of it, you know, how it really works, Bettina?
Sure. So I think what is not unique to CAR T cell therapy, we experience this in stem cell transplant as well with our patient population, is different people will absorb different amounts of information when you give it to them. I'm seeing patients often in the inpatient setting when they're coming in for therapy and somebody has already addressed what the therapy is with them. My practice, how I approach it is when I'm admitting them and I'm doing their HMP when they're coming in, I prompt them by asking them, what is your understanding of what we're doing here? You're not being given a test or anything like that, but tell me what your understanding is. So I make sure that they understand they're going to be receiving some chemotherapy, that they're going to be receiving these cells, and then also that they have an understanding of the toxicities, including the risk for cytokine release syndrome and neurologic toxicity or ICANS. So we talk about the brief signs and symptoms of those. I make sure that they can teach it back to me, and I give an opportunity for both the patient and their caregiver to ask questions, because in addition to the patients, we often have caregivers with them. We actually recommend a 24/7 family or friend to be there for support during treatment. So it's important that they understand as well, especially for the neurologic toxicity, because often the patient won't remember that or really know what's going on. So it's important that everyone involved understands.
So we're going to go through a few slides, but you can check those out later too. We're not going to go through every single slide that we sent you in the slide deck. But Sattva, maybe again, you can talk a little bit more, maybe before you get to that, we had a poll question we were going to ask the audience. So here's the question, because, you know, is this relevant to you in your practice, the topic of CAR T? So my question to you is, when's the last time you saw a patient in your practice who died of either large cell lymphoma, multiple myeloma, or ALL? So you would think that any patient who dies theoretically would be a candidate at some point in time. It'll be kind of curious to see. It looks like the vast, vast majority of our audience has seen patients like that and in the last 6 months or so. So I think this is going to be a very relevant topic for everybody tonight. Tiffany, can you talk a little bit about how you explain what CAR T therapy is to a patient?
Yeah, I mean, similar to what Patina said, is to try and break it down into simple terms, making sure that they understand what's going to happen, what the process is, making sure that they understand the side effects with CRS and the neurotoxicity. In myeloma, we don't see as much neurotoxicity as they see in lymphoma and leukemia, so it's not as much of a significant issue. However, they still need to be aware of it, and their family members need to be aware of what to look for, because a lot of times the family member may notice the slight alteration that a patient's having. And so it's really, really important that the caregiver that's with them is aware and knows what to look for.
And we're going to talk about some of the toxicity issues that come up. Very, very interesting. And we'll hear a lot about how they're actually managed. But let's keep going, though, in terms of sort of the biology. And Sattva, maybe you can talk a little bit about sort of what's going on, how we prepare CAR T treatment and how it's helpful to patients.
Sure. So CAR T cell therapy, it's a form of genetically engineered T cell therapy. You can see here in this cartoon on the left, you have a T cell. And we introduce an artificial receptor into this T cell, which is the CAR molecule or chimeric antigen receptor. And that's done with the help of a virus, usually either a retrovirus or a lentivirus. And once we infect that cell with this virus, it will express this artificial receptor, the CAR molecule, on the cell surface. And what that does is, if you see on the right, that artificial receptor helps it to recognize certain antigens on the surface of the tumor cell. And once it recognizes that antigen, it can do three different things. It will, the cells will start to multiply and proliferate. They can produce multiple different cytokines, which are helpful to mediate the anti-tumor effect, but also cause some of the inflammatory side effects that we see with these patients. And then most importantly, they kill the tumor cells, which you see here. And this is shown on this slide is as well. Oh, so on the left side is a normal T cell. So a normal T cell recognizes its target through the T cell receptor, which is the native normally expressed T cell receptor. On the right is what you see, the chimeric antigen receptor, which is the genetically engineered receptor. And it's called chimeric because it has two parts to it. There is the part that is expressed on the cell surface, which is the antigen recognition domain. And then there is a cytoplasmic part, which provides the activation signal to the T cell when the target antigen is recognized by extracellular domain. And here's the general treatment schema for CAR T cell therapy. So currently for the FDA approved products, the patients initially undergo leukapheresis, which is basically to harvest the T cells from the patient. And then once the product has been generated, which can typically take about 3 to 4 weeks, they receive the conditioning chemotherapy, usually with cyclophosphamide and fludarabine, which is given over 3 days on day minus 5, 4, and 3. And after 2 days of rest, they received the CAR T-cell infusion on day zero. And then the toxicities, which you'll hear more about, typically occur within the first 2 weeks after the infusion. So this is the most critical period to monitor these patients closely, either as inpatient or outpatient. And this therapy acts fairly rapidly. So we can generally see a good clinical response by 1 month. So usually the first tumor assessment is done by day 30.
So Nikhil, maybe you can talk a little bit more about the fact that there are different products. There's not just one CAR T product, there are several, and kind of what the difference is between the products.
So there are three components to CAR T. As the top component, the one in the top shown here, that is utilized to identify the specific tumor cells. So that looks at specific expressed molecule on the tumor cell, and it allows the CAR T cell to recognize the tumor cell. It could say targeting homing mechanism. So for lymphoma, CD19 is the commonest one. For myeloma, as you will see, BCMA is a common one. And there are many other similar target molecules being identified. And so that differentiates different CAR products. Number two, the signal two molecule mentioned in this figure is what is called co-stimulatory molecule that allows this tumor T-cell, immune cell interaction to happen more robustly. And here you could have CD28, you could have 4-1BB and some of the newer other molecules. And that may be the second difference between the various CAR product. The third component, signal one, is very similar across, which is CD3-zeta, which allows the T-cells to get activated and replicate and get bigger in number. And so based on what is specifically on the surface of the CAR T-cell, is what is recognized as the type of CAR T cell it is. And so the products may be different based on the surface molecule and the signal too. The name of the CAR T cell, whether it is CD19 CAR T cells or BCMA CAR T cell, is based on what specifically on the tumor cell is being recognized by the CAR T cells.
So we're going to move on in a second and talk about the case and start to give you a flavor of what really happens to patients who get treated, particularly as it relates to toxicity. But Krishna, maybe you could just, rather than showing a whole bunch of slides and all the trials that have been done, you can just kind of put in perspective the kind of benefits that we're seeing in various populations. We're talking about myeloma, lymphoma, acute leukemia, in terms of how well patients respond when really they're running out of options.
Yeah, I think the best way to say this is that we're fortunate in pediatric leukemia to have gone from cure rates that were effectively zero at the beginning of the 1960s to maybe 20% in the beginning of the 1970s to now in children, and I'm an adult hematologist, but in pediatric leukemia, ALL, reliably 80 to 90% of patients or even higher are cured now with combination chemotherapy. And in lymphoma, the disease that Dr. Neelapu specializes in, we've gotten very good at curing a majority of patients who present with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. So both of these diseases can be cured with combination chemotherapy approaches. But there are two subsets of patients, and fortunately, you know, one is more rare than others. The first one is a subset of patients who never responds, patients who are truly refractory, that is that they don't really respond to chemotherapy at all. The second is a group of patients that actually responds, that goes into remission and has a chance for a cure, but then they relapse. And again, many of those patients, if they relapse, can be cured with transplants for lymphoma and get chemotherapy and get high dose chemotherapy and autologous transplants where they get their own cells back. Or for leukemia, they can get donor transplants or allogeneic transplants. But for patients who don't fit into those categories, they historically have had a terrible prognosis. And again, you know, we could go over different studies and different diseases. But in general, of those patients who are relapsed or highly refractory, typically no more than 20 or 30% of patients will even respond to chemotherapy. And the percentage of patients who actually achieve a complete response is typically less than 10%. And if you don't achieve a complete response in those diseases, you'll typically die within months. So we're talking about the background in which these diseases were introduced in these what we call pivotal trials, or the trials that led to approval, were highly terrible situations. Curable diseases, but for relapsed and refractory patients, almost certain to die with their next line of therapy. So CAR T cells were put into these therapies, and in the vast majority of patients, actually, people achieve responses, and the majority of patients actually achieve complete responses. Unfortunately, not all of those patients are cured. Less than half of patients with the lymphoma and leukemia are cured now, but we're talking a dramatic, really fundamental, revolutionary difference relative to what we would expect.
I should mention that, you know, Tiffany and Nikhil both focus on myeloma, and the CAR T is a little bit of a different story there, a different target. But again, Tiffany, just sort of macro in terms of seeing these patients in terms of the benefit, can you comment on what you've observed so far?
Yeah, I mean, I think for a lot of our patients, the CAR T has provided not just remission, but remission without treatment. And I think that's really important for our myeloma patients, because particularly once you've relapsed, patients are basically on indefinite therapy now from the time of induction all the way throughout their journey. They're on maintenance therapy, and then they relapse, and then they're on therapy again, and they just stay on it. Whereas if with CAR T, they're actually provided a treatment-free duration. And I think that's really important when we're talking about a patient's quality of life. And so while we're still anticipating to see the full benefits of CAR T, though we do know that those patients who get a complete response from CAR T are having long PFS and not only progression-free survival, but that's without treatment. And I think that's incredibly, incredibly important for our patients.
So I see that the chat room is starting to pick up a little bit. I encourage you to ask questions in there. Or someone asked a question about how the cells are collected, and SOTFA responded. And, you know, another thing, SOTFA, about this is there's a little bit of a delay between the time you decide you want to give CAR T, you collect the cells, and then bring it back to the patient. How much of a problem is that in terms of patient having disease progression while you're waiting?
Right. So I think for the current products that are FDA approved, they're approved for aggressive malignancies, both ALL and diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. So these patients can have rapidly progressive disease. So I think so the time is very critical. Currently, it takes us about a week to get insurance approval. Once we identify a patient, at that point, we schedule the leukapheresis for the cell collection. And after the cell collection, as I mentioned, it takes about 3 weeks to get the product manufactured. So during that time, if there is disease progression, we need to consider bridging therapy for these patients to be able to at least stabilize the disease and maybe also induce a certain degree of response or debulk the tumor to some extent, which could potentially decrease toxicity for these patients. So currently, from the time we identify a patient to the time when we can infuse the product, it can take 5 to 6 weeks. So we don't really need to do the planning for that.
So let's bring in a little granularity how this really plays out. I met with each faculty person, this entire series of conferences, every single one of them. I spent an hour with the faculty ahead of time. We record a presentation. We chat. There's a lot of great content there. We're going to be releasing that this summer. It was really interesting chatting with Bettina because she's in the inpatient setting and really, you know, gets to see the way this process evolves. And when I saw that she had a case of a patient who was not able to receive blood products, that, of course, got my attention, which is the case for this 73-year-old lady. I think we talked about this case for about 20 minutes, but we're just going to pick out a couple aspects, and then you can watch Bettina's video and get all the other things that happened to this lady. But maybe you could just kind of summarize what happened with this woman, Bettina, where the issue, the fact that she wouldn't accept blood products fit in, and kind of what happened when she got treated.
This was a very lovely lady who presented to us for CAR T cell therapy. She was referred from an outside physician to our institution. And in her prior treatment history, there was a point about a year ago where she was evaluated for possible referral for an autologous stem cell transplant. Anyone who works in stem cell transplant knows that if you get a stem cell transplant and we give you a very high dose chemotherapy, you're very likely going to require blood products during the recovery process. Due to that and also the cadence of her disease, it was decided that an autologous stem cell transplant was not the best option for her. She came to us for CAR T cell therapy. Unfortunate for her, at the very beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. So she came into what we have is a hybrid outpatient clinic for her evaluation, and she got her first doses of chemotherapy before being admitted. And she got the chemotherapy. She stayed there for about an additional hour or two. And by the time she hit the inpatient floor and the nurses took her vitals on arrival, she was found to have a fever. So she required a very robust infectious workup prior to us continuing chemotherapy and eventually giving her CAR T cells. However, she did receive the cells. Afterwards, she developed fevers again about 2 days after, pretty early on average for lymphoma patients to be having fevers that early. So she received tocilizumab and steroids at that time, had a very nice response, had some mild issues, including some double vision and recurrent C. diff infection. When we were monitoring her inflammatory markers, they were rather high during this time. But overall, she tolerated treatment very well, went home just under 2 weeks after she got the cells. Her repeat imaging a month later showed CR, and she's currently at home with her family, her adult children who take care of her and she lives with, having some issues with recurrent infections, but overall doing pretty well.
So we're going to use this case as a way to start to get into the issue of side effects and toxicity of CAR T therapy. And I guess one question that comes up, Krishna, is what kind of shape does somebody have to be in performance status wise in order to be able to be considered for CAR T therapy? And, you know, we think about, for example, autologous transplant as something that we don't think about in 80-year-olds, et cetera. What about criteria to receive CAR T, particularly, you know, you have a patient who doesn't have any options, Krishna?
Great question. Only correct you slightly, and that's that we just looked at our last 212 transplants that we performed, autologous transplants for lymphoma and myeloma, and we had one death out of those 216 transplants. And we are now actually starting to do transplants in 75 to 80-year-olds, even for lymphoma, but really with almost low mortality. I think it's very important to know that in general, the easiest way to say that is we can treat patients with CAR T cells who appear to be sicker than the average patient who's a candidate for autologous transplant. And importantly, and it's a complicated story, but trials that led to approval were done generally with healthier patients. And there are a lot of studies that Dr. Neelapu and I and others have been a part of that basically showed that about half of the people who are being treated with the approved products wouldn't have qualified for the trials that led to their approval. They tend to be older, they tend to be sicker, and yet, I think remarkably, they tend to have about the same responses that the patients did in the original clinical trials. Now, a few percent of people actually will have serious life-threatening and even fatal complications. That's been true. It's a little bit hard to get the exact numbers. So this is probably not less likely to lead to death than an autologous transplant, but these patients are typically refractory patients who wouldn't necessarily qualify. And age, there doesn't appear to be an upper limit. There are patients who have been treated well into their 80s. I think the oldest two patients in the registries are about 89 years old. So there is no upper limit. And I think one of the key things, I think, for people who refer to us is get patients to us early and don't assume that you know who will or won't be a candidate. Let us do that. We can usually get people in within 1 to 3 days. That, you know, there are some gymnastics in terms of approvals and other things. But quickly, get on the phone, talk to us. We'll let you know whether we think that it's a reasonable prospect. So before you throw in the towel, you know, let us evaluate that, and we can usually quickly do that.
So we want to focus in terms of the toxicity on two major issues, cytokine release syndrome and neurotoxicity, and also I'm curious about some of the apps that are out there to help people manage these problems. Starting with cytokine release, Bettina, can you comment? This lady had some element of cytokine release. Can you talk about sort of when it starts, how it usually presents, and how you manage it?
This lady, she did have some cytokine release. With the product that she received, typically you would see an onset a few days later than she had an onset of day 2 after cell infusion. And typically it presents with a fever. Patients can also have hypoxia and hypotension. They can have organ toxicities. However, the organ toxicities currently are not part of our grading system that we're using at my institution. However, we do monitor for them. But typically patients will present with a fever during this time period, and we do warn patients and their families about that. A little bit after the cytokine release has its average appearance, we see the neurotoxicity after that. But for her, she had fevers and I believe also some hypotension and tachycardia as well at that time.
And we'll talk a little bit about the neurotoxicity. Nikhil, can you comment a little bit about cytokine storm? You know, we hear that term nowadays a lot as it relates to COVID. Can you kind of compare the two?
Yeah, so basically cytokine release syndrome or cytokine storm comes about because of this massive growth of the immune cell, which is observed. Partly it is necessary because when the CAR T cell recognizes tumor cell, binds to it and kills it, in the process, because of this genetic manipulation, they are programmed to grow. And they grow 1,000-fold, 10,000-fold, and even more. And this sudden, very acute growth of the immune cell also leads to production of various cytokines, various chemicals by these T cells and immune cells. These cytokines are in general meant for the immune cells to help each other to be even more robust. But the side effect ends up being that it also overwhelms the system. There are many other impacts on the body. For example, the commonest side effect Patina described is fever. And fever happens because of this increase in IL-6, interleukin-6. And that's one of the cytokines that I can mention. There are many other cytokines. So an acute growth or changes in the immune cell is on one side. What happens in COVID is in some ways similar. When one gets in severe infection, the COVID-related infection, that, for example, is localized into the lung system to start with, there is intense inflammatory response that happens locally. And a lot of inflammatory cytokines are produced in the process, which is body's immune process to sort of control it. But in the process of controlling it, there are a lot of cytokines produced as a control mechanism that in fact end up causing more damage because it's an uncontrolled production of all these cytokines. And that in some ways similar to what we observe in the cytokine release syndrome with the CAR T cell. And then we begin to know what the treatments are, and we'll discuss, talk more about it. But interleukin-6 is the cytokine that causes the biggest, most prominent impact. IL-1 is other, and there were a few other cytokines which are of importance, TNF-alpha, interferon alpha, etc. But IL-6 being one of the major cytokines, giving the most prominent impact with fever and respiratory issues and hypoxias and cardiac impact, etc., the treatment ends up being to block it. Tocilizumab or IL-6 receptor antibodies, one, you can use IL-6 receptor. Steroids is part of the same process because it can decrease interleukin-6. And as you see, begin to see the COVID literature, which is still evolving, tocilizumab ends up being one of the important treatments for it. And it also provides benefit in quite a significant way. So this cytokine storm is not a necessary evil, but it's something that we do observe. It is connected in many cases with the response. There are patients who do not get it and still respond. So you don't have to have it, but it's present, as you will see, in majority of the patient in myeloma, it's 80 to 90% of the time of different grades. And it can be treated because we can go after the cytokine and control it. And that's how use of this control mechanism have increased, and the treatments are becoming safer and also becoming less toxic as we move on with understanding of this process.
Tiffany, any comments about both cytokine release and neurotoxicity in myeloma patients? I think you mentioned earlier that it seems like maybe it's not as intense in the myeloma patients. Any comment on that, Tiffany?
Yeah, so for CRS, you know, we do see about 80% of patients that will develop CRS. But of those, only about 6% in various trials develop grade 3 or grade 4. So it's mostly going to be grade 1 and grade 2. And same with ICANS, we do see grade 1 and grade 2 on neurotoxicity. But again, the grade 3 and grade 4 neurotoxicity is a very low percentage. And so I think for us, when we're talking about the side effects of CAR T with our myeloma patients, we do have that advantage. And patients are not as scared about the side effects, because I think CAR T has been around enough now that our patients hear about what's happening in lymphoma. And in our center, our myeloma patients share a lobby with the lymphoma patients. So there's a lot of crosstalk that happens between patients. And so I think that is one definite advantage that our myeloma patients do have.
Of course, the good news here is, as opposed to many of the therapies, chemotherapy, et cetera, we use, this only occurs, you know, one time. You're only treated once. So it's not at least a chronic situation. Yeah. Bettina, the other big issue is neurotoxicity. You referred to it. It sounds like your lady really didn't have much of a problem. I think you were mentioning the double vision she'd had previously. But when you do see neurotoxicity, Bettina, when do you tend to see it, and what do you usually see?
I will say that I have seen it happen actually earlier than what most of the data would suggest. But on average, you're going to see it a little bit later, around day 7, about a week after they get the cells. It can vary from patient to patient, but I would say in my experience, especially with lymphoma patients, what I have observed is you'll see somebody, especially if you've been seeing them in the prior days, who's been very sharp, take a little bit more time to process information. When they're performing the ICE score assessment with our nursing staff, you'll see that they can still answer orientation questions and do serial subtraction. However, they might have to think about it a little bit more than normal. And that will progress to often them having issues being able to answer questions, some expressive aphasia, some general confusion. Just, I would say we get a handwriting sample. You'll see that somebody will go from being able to give you a very nice, neat handwriting sample to something that looks kind of jarbled and doesn't make any sense.
Of course, Safa, a key thing here down mentioned at the bottom is that this is reversible. I don't know if we even understand why people get that. You had a paper where you looked at the handwriting of patients, kind of gets into some of the subtle signs of the neurotoxicity that you really kind of have to look for. Can you comment on that?
So when we were first doing these trials, we were doing the 30-point mini mental status exams on these patients. And we noticed that one of the earliest signs of neurotoxicity in these patients appears to be this impairment of handwriting. So you can see in this particular patient on day 4, her handwriting was normal. Her baseline MMSE score was 29 over 30. But on day 5, she has significant impairment of her handwriting, but she was still able to answer most of the other questions, such as orientation to time, place, etc. She could name her family members and so forth, but the handwriting was markedly impaired. So with her MMSE score being 27 over 30. And by the next day, you could see that her handwriting returned back to baseline. So there are elements in the neurological exam that we find to be affected very early on. So one is the handwriting and the other is their inability to count the numbers backwards. So we generally assess this by their ability to count backwards from 100 by 10. This is part of the new consensus grading system that was put forward by the ASTCT. It's now done by nurse practitioners, physicians at the bedside, can be done several times a day. It's just a 10-point score. For each correct answer, we assign a point. And again, even in the 10-point score, one of them is to look at their ability to write a sentence. And that's usually one of the ones that's most affected early on.
So Krishna, any comments on both CRS as well as neurotoxicity? And is this virtually always reversible, Krishna, or do you sometimes see long-term sequelae? What typically happens in these patients?
At a really high level, the CRS tends to happen the first week. The neurotoxicity tends to happen kind of the end of the first week to the second week. It almost always responds and resolves completely. A small subset of patients will have, you know, very serious complications and can even die, even in the myeloma studies where it's much more rare, but still deaths have been reported. But I think for patients who get past that, and the vast majority of them will, they will return to virtually normal function. There are some studies of long-term cognitive function to see if there are any issues. You know, I think the only other thing I would say is that Dr. Nilipu said, you know, he and I and others worked to kind of standardize these grading systems. And you asked about apps. The ASTCT actually has an app. And, you know, there's actually a grading calculators. You can't really see this on my thing, but there's a CARTOX app. And then the ASTCT has an app that's freely downloadable from the app store. And you can actually put it in. You can put in, it'll tell you the ICE score, the ICANN score, and the overall ASTCT grading system, which is now the consensus grading system. The early trials of these different products actually use three different grading systems. So it's really hard to compare exactly across trials what the incidence of neurotoxicity or cytokine release syndrome was. It was one of the reasons that Dr. Nilipu and I actually helped to lead that effort to really standardize the grading system. And that was an important thing. And now we have a very solid kind of consistent grading system.
So Tiffany, we showed the picture of the app from MD Anderson. There's a bunch of different apps and different guidelines. Any comments about utilizing these kinds of approaches in managing patients, Tiffany?
Yeah, an app that MD Anderson developed is really useful, and it was actually developed by one of our research nurse practitioners. She worked with our IT department. And so it's easy. You can put in what symptoms the patients are having. It'll tell you the grade, and then it'll also provide the management for you so that it's quick. You can quickly look at it in order to be able to provide the best management for the patient. So I think these apps are really, really handy, particularly for nurses, nurse practitioners, if you're starting to see changes in your patients, that you can quickly identify what's happening with your patient.
So we're going to go to another case and try to get a little more into what happens to these people, particularly when they get some of these complications. But Krishna, maybe you can comment on sort of right now where CAR-T is being done and where you see in the future, if we're going to have more and more CAR-T patients, how it's going to be filtered out into the community. It seems like it's the transplanters are going to be doing this.
Well, I wouldn't say it's transplanted. For example, Dr. Neelapu is one of the leading figures in the field and is not a transplant doc, but he's, you know, really, I think, become a cell therapist. And I think one of the things that we would say, you know, there's some disagreement around this, but I would say it's a general consensus that this should be done in experienced centers that can recognize and develop a multidisciplinary approach. And in that sense, there are a lot of parallels with transplant. For both transplant and these immune effector cell therapies, there's an accrediting organization, and the ASTCT and the ISCT actually came together to develop an organization called FACT, which actually provides a set of standards that get frequently revised, and they created a set of immune effector cell standards. I think if you ask, you know, the physicians on this panel or others, we would tell you, go to a center that has FACT accreditation for immune effector cell therapies. Right now, that's a relatively high bar that requires you to be treated in one of around 100-ish centers for each of the two products. It means that we're not delivering it in rural oncology clinics, but that provides an assurance and a checklist and a multidisciplinary approach that is vetted. And I think that that's important. It's kind of an accreditation process. I think as products become less toxic, certainly we're seeing a big difference between the CD19 products and the BCMA products that Dr. Munshi is going to tell us more about. We're going to see safer administration. And I think at some point it will be safer. My feeling is that these should always be done in the context of a program that has some kind of external validation and accreditation. And I think that standard will change and it will allow more community-based care, but it provides an assurance both to payers and to physicians who are referring, nurses who are referring, and to patients themselves that set of standards and environment is safe. And I think that's really critical right now.
So we're going to spend the rest of our time talking about sort of how these strategies fit into these three settings, these clinical settings where CAR T therapy has been utilized. We'll also talk in the end a little bit about where things might be heading in the future, whether or not we can learn from what happened here with CAR T to develop other therapies that may be less expensive, less toxic, maybe off the shelf without having to be autologous. We'll talk about that in a second. But let's talk about sort of where CAR T fits in terms of myeloma. And Tiffany, I guess one of the issues with myeloma is that now the target is BCMA. And maybe you can comment a little bit about sort of what the CAR T preparations are that are being used in myeloma and what the situations are. And then we're going to go through sort of what's happening in myeloma and where CAR T fits in. But maybe you can comment a little bit about the type of CAR T preparation, Tiffany.
Most of the trials right now are targeting BCMA, which stands for B-cell maturation antigen. And there's three main trials that are starting to present data: the KARMA trial, the EVOLVE trial, and the CARTITUDE trial. And for KARMA, there's various treatment points of relapse for the KARMA. So there's patients who are at relapse refractory. There's a KARMA study for patients who are relapsing early from stem cell. And so trying to see if we can potentially have not just a higher response rate earlier in the course of the disease, but also a longer progression-free survival for patients. So they're very encouraging. The response rates are about 80 to 90% in all three trials. CR rates are almost up to 30%. And for patients with relapse refractory disease, if we can think about for a single agent drug, the response rates that we're seeing now in myeloma at relapse refractory disease, it's about 30%. And so these trials have significant increase in their response rates, as well as in their progression-free survival.
So Nikhil, maybe you can talk a little bit about sort of what's going on, so to speak, in myeloma. We know there's been a lot of recent interest in the issue of the initial upfront treatment of myeloma, and whether the anti-CD38 antibody daratumumab is going to be included in that. If we can go to the slides. Also, the issue of minimal residual disease and where that fits in the management of myeloma, including the role of transplant. Can you talk a little bit, Nikhil, before we sort of get more into where CAR T fits in, kind of where things are nowadays in myeloma, and what are some of the key questions out there?
Yes, so what has happened standard in myeloma is a three-drug regimen: proteasome inhibitor, immunomodulator, and dexamethasone, whichever of the three you use. That provides 100% response rate around 40% complete remission. However, the high-risk patients still don't do well. So now we have a fourth drug available, the antibody, daratumumab, and there is another antibody, isatuximab, and there's a third antibody, elotuzumab. And these antibodies have a very significant response even in relapse patients. So now, as it happens in every other setting, we are utilizing antibody upfront in a four-drug regimen, daratumumab with the three drug that I just described, are providing deeper responses, better responses, and to some extent, and that is still not clear, a better control even in high-risk patient population. That is still ongoing research, but we are beginning to have the fourth drug added in the upfront setting. Although standard of care is still three drug, in the higher-risk patient population, for example, we do use a fourth drug to get deeper and better response. And that's where the point comes about deeper response. And deeper response is defined by getting minimal residual negative using 10 to minus 5. So what it means translate into that if we cannot see one myeloma cell in the bone marrow out of 100,000 cell, that's MRD to 10 to minus 5. And we are even going to 10 to minus 6, where we do not even have one myeloma cell in a million. So that's the depth of response we are trying to get. And there is very ample data. We just did a 8,000 patient analysis, which shows that when patients get this MRD negativity, they have a much superior outcome in regards to progression-free survival and also overall survival. So that's where we want to go. And so when we use this three or four top drug in the beginning, what do we do with patients who relapse? The good news in myeloma is that we have at least six more drugs after we have used these four drugs in the beginning to go for even further responses. The caveat, and that's where our discussion on CAR T cells will come, that as we use next line and the next line of treatment, the frequency of response goes down and also the progression-free survival goes down. So when I go to the second line and then the third line, beyond third line, which is where we use CAR T cell, expected responses are in the range of around 30%, 25 to 30%. And PFS ends up being around 3 to 4 months. And so even though we have drug, even though the drugs work, our benefit from those drugs keep on going down. And that's where we need treatments that are much more effective, gets better, deeper response, and also longer response. And to point to the MRD negativity, when we go third line and beyond, very rarely patients get MRD negativity. So being able to get MRD negativity in relapse patients is another important point to keep in mind.
So we want to go back to a case now. Tiffany, you have a 58-year-old lady. And it's interesting, she was diagnosed in 2012. Before you start talking about her, I'm just kind of curious, you know, when you see a new patient with myeloma nowadays and you start to paint a picture for them in terms of what to expect for the future, this lady's already survived 8 years. What are you telling patients nowadays to expect for the typical myeloma scenario, Tiffany?
Yeah, so if they're standard risk disease, we tell them that the median expectancy is about 8 to 10 years, but that we see patients every day that have lived more than 10 years. And I also tell them to don't go Googling on the internet because the internet will scare them and because they'll read that their life expectancy is 5 years. So I think that's really important when talking with patients who have, particularly we have standard risk disease. Patients who have high-risk disease, that's a little bit of a different conversation because their prognosis is poorer, particularly those patients who have deletion to 17p. And so that's always a really difficult conversation because you want to have hope, but you also want them to have realistic expectations because they're probably not going to be the patient that lives 10 years with their disease. So that's always a really hard conversation to try and juggle with patients. And depending on your patient, you kind of have to tailor that message depending on kind of their personality and how much they want to hear. I've had patients who will say, I don't want to hear anything, and the spouse is like, well, I want to know. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, I say to the patient, do you want to know this? And if they say no, then I'm like, okay, case is closed. We aren't going to talk about it, because if the patient doesn't want to hear it, then we need to respect that. So that can be a little bit difficult when the caregiver and the patient want to know different types of information.
So let's take a brief look at the two cases that you pulled here, also just to kind of get a flavor of how these cases evolved. And Nikhil, you were talking about the fact that these people often get multiple lines of therapy. And Tiffany, it looks like this patient also has received multiple different combinations. What was her situation when she was considered for the CAR T therapy?
Yeah, so she had had several multiple lines of therapy. I think she was at 8 prior lines of therapy. She was relapsing. And so we had talked to her previously. We had been talking to her about CAR T-cell just because we knew that we were going to start running out of treatment options. And so we really wanted to consider CAR T-cell. And so when a clinical trial slot opened up, she jumped into it. She was like, okay, she lives out of state. She's like, I'll come. I will stay as long as I need to in Houston. It's not a problem. Very enthusiastic about it. And so she received her leukodepletion chemotherapy outpatient and then was admitted for the CAR T-cell therapy. She had only a minimal response. However, she was off therapy for 6 months. This was last year that she had our CAR T, so it was the first time in 7 years that she was off therapy. And so while she didn't have a great response during that time, she also wasn't on any therapy. And so that was good for her. She did develop these diffuse arthralgias, about 6 weeks post CAR T cell infusion. And so we actually had her see rheumatology and they ordered like a Medrol dose pack and were attributing it to the CAR T because she had never had this before. It was the only thing that had changed, resolved with the steroids and has not recurred since then.
Kind of curious, Bettina, have you ever seen arthralgias in a patient with CAR T?
That's interesting. Nobody jumps to mind off the top of my head. We have had some patients just overall that have had, for example, one of our ALL patients did have some whole body aches, but it was difficult because she had also had complaints like that before she got the cell infusion. So then after the cell infusion, it's difficult to just attribute it to that.
So here's another case of a patient actually had a great response. Tiffany, a 62-year-old man, what happened there?
Yeah, so he actually had a translocation 14-16 at the time he was diagnosed. He was high-risk myeloma, received bortezomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone, went on to receive an autologous stem cell transplant and was placed on lenalidomide maintenance and unfortunately progressed after 4 months. He had received DARA combinations with very short remission time. And so then into December of 2019, he went on a clinical trial with BB2121. He did develop fevers, rigors, and wheezing. He was placed on oxygen. He was found to have grade 2 CRS, received acetaminophen and on nebulizer treatments, and his CRS resolved after 2 days. But he achieved a CR, and he remains in a CR 6 months post his CAR T. He did have elevation of his C-reactive protein and ferritin, which is to be expected, but he's done really well. And you can see by his graph, this was really the first time he achieved that type of response.
And I was curious about these. We were chatting, Bettina, and you were telling me about your cases. You were bringing up the fact that you look at assays such as C-reactive protein and ferritin as part of managing these patients. How do you interpret that? Where does that fit in?
Yeah, so at our center, it's important for us to start monitoring these before they get the cell infusion so we have a good baseline, because often these patients will have elevations in both their C-reactive protein and their ferritin independent of the CAR T cells. But when they start to have toxicities, especially fevers and other signs and symptoms of cytokine release, if we're seeing a pretty significant uptick in those markers, we have a better sense of the possibility that it may be cell infusion related, although they can also be elevated in infection. But we're monitoring the CRP very closely, as well as the ferritin. And the ferritin we also monitor in case they may be developing HLH, which has been a development that we've seen in multiple patients.
Bettina, you have the opportunity to see people getting CAR T for a variety of reasons. You know, we're talking about different cancers here. The thought that maybe the myeloma preparations, they don't have as much toxicity. Any sort of global observations you've made in terms of sort of the level of toxicity you see in myeloma versus ALL versus lymphoma, for example?
Yeah, you know, I will agree that on average, the myeloma patients are not having the level of toxicities we've seen in the other diseases. However, that being said, at my center, we have had 2 very sick myeloma patients on trial getting CAR T-cell therapy. The lymphoma patients all are a pretty average amount of toxicity. We honestly do not have too many of them right now that end up in our ICU. I would say that our sickest ones are usually the ALL patients at our center.
The two patients with myeloma that had problems, was that CRS, neurotoxicity? What happened there?
Both of them had a cluster of a lot of things go wrong at the same time. One of them had multi-system organ failure. He had kidney failure, a very severe infection. He had grade 4 cytokine release. He was intubated and sedated, so it was difficult to assess his mental status during that time, but he ultimately succumbed to a pretty serious infection.
So, Nikhil, you showed this slide here of a patient you took care of who got CAR T. Can you tell us the story behind it?
Yeah, so when we talk about quality of life, this is a good example. So this patient was multiply treated. He had more than 8 lines of treatment with a high-risk disease and relapse. Was entered on this study earlier on. This was almost 2.5-3 years ago. And received the same BB2121 CAR-T. As you can see in this slide, on day 14, the bone marrow had totally cleared. The responses are very, very fast. Median time to response is 1 month. And we usually, by day 10, when patients are getting ready to be discharged, there's a clear evidence of response as by measuring light chain and other proteins. In her case, also in 1 month, the PET CT scan totally normalized. So again, those lesions disappeared within a month. And the picture on the left is what she sent me 3 months after discharge, just amplifying and telling us that the quality of life improves. And there was actually a presentation at ASCO on quality of life following CAR T cells in myeloma. And it clearly showed that all the measures that we look for in quality of life, from fatigue to pain and general well-being, they all improved as a global phenomenon for all the patients put together in the KARMA study. But also, if you look at proportion of patients with fatigue or improvement in fatigue, almost doubled from 30-35% to 70% once they were recovered from their side effects. So yes, side effects are there. And as described very well, they are a little less in myeloma. But once they overcome the side effect, their general quality of life significantly improves. They get back to their work. And very important point in myeloma, which has also been stressed by Tiffany, is that patients at the present time do not get anything. So they get one shot treatment and they do not get anything. That's something we need to work on, because in myeloma, we need maintenance treatment. So we are developing some of those efforts to sustain the good remission we get. But currently, they are without any treatment and their quality of life is outstanding.
Myeloma people, you know, have this idea of continuous therapy, but I think it's a good point that Tiffany made about the fact that it's great for these people who are getting continuous therapy over 8 or 10 years to give them a little bit of a break. Sattva, we had a question in the chat room earlier I want to bring up, and we get this question not only about CAR T, but also about checkpoint inhibitors, which is the issue of using corticosteroids. We know they can be helpful with some of these problems, including cytokine release. But the question is it sort of having a negative effect on the anti-tumor benefit that you're seeing? Any comment on that, Sattva?
Yes, so I think you heard earlier that one of the critical cytokines that seem to be important for cytokine release syndrome is IL-6. So that's what led to the use of anti-IL-6 therapy. But what's been observed in multiple trials across multiple different CAR-T products is that there are many different cytokines that are associated with both cytokine release syndrome and neurological toxicity. And this is when the inflammation gets activated, it's really a cascade that gets activated. So earlier on, it's mainly the IL-1 and IL-6 are the key players. But after a few more days, there are a host of other cytokines and chemokines that get produced in the body as well. So when anti-IL-6 therapy alone does not work, one may need to use something like corticosteroids, because corticosteroids can cause broad immune suppression. They suppress multiple different immune cells, including T cells, macrophages, B cells, NK cells. In addition, they suppress multiple different cytokines and chemokines. When patients have severe toxicity that's not being controlled with tocilizumab, we generally use corticosteroids. But as was mentioned by Dr. Love, corticosteroids can have a negative effect on the T cells. They suppress the function of T cells as well as the proliferation of the T cells. And they can also be cytotoxic, meaning they can kill the T cells. So obviously, we don't want that. But what's been observed in the trials is that if we use corticosteroids for severe toxicity, they don't seem to have a harmful effect because, and the reason why we think that is the case is the patients who get the more severe toxicity, they have very huge amplification of their CAR T cell numbers. So what the corticosteroids do is to temporarily dampen that response to be able to manage the side effects. But we do definitely need much more studies to look at the effect of corticosteroids on clinical outcomes. We recently presented an abstract at ASCO where we looked at the cumulative dose of corticosteroids, and we found that there seems to be a difference, especially in the patients who have received very high cumulative dose of steroids. So I think there's a lot more research that needs to be done, and there's definitely other alternative agents to overcome toxicities need to be developed. And one of the agents that's being looked at that looked very promising in preclinical models is anti-IL-1 therapy or anakinra. And anakinra is now being used as a third agent again for toxicity management at a number of different centers, although this is considered off-label use at this point. And clinical trials have recently been initiated to test it more formally.
We're going to talk about probably the most common situation where you're going to hear about a patient getting CAR T therapy, specifically diffuse large B cell lymphoma. Myeloma, right now, the only way you can get CAR T therapy is on a clinical trial because none of these preparations are approved. But now we're going to talk about lymphoma and ALL. Well, we do have approved therapies. And Christian, we can start out just kind of painting an overview of where we are today with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. We know that a certain fraction of these patients can be cured up front with regimens like R-CHOP. They can be sent for autologous transplant for recurrent disease. And it's kind of in that post-transplant space for patients who are continuing to have active disease that CAR-T is being considered. But can you kind of paint a little bit of a picture of where things are today, Krishna, with the management of diffuse large B-cell? What are some of the key questions? And then where CAR-T is fitting in?
Yeah, so depending on the age of the patient and risk factors and type of lymphoma, 60 to 80% of patients ballpark will be cured with combination chemotherapy. And we know that that tends to be our CHOP. We've tried to do more intensification, and generally that has not been successful. So patients who relapse, assuming that they're chemosensitive, they can be cured with autologous transplant. So the typical thing is that they get salvage therapy and they get high-dose chemotherapy and an autologous transplant. And while nobody wants to get an autologous transplant, their hair falls out. They end up spending 3 weeks to 3.5 weeks in the hospital. The mortality of that, as I noted, even in individuals these days routinely to 75 years old, is really good. If you fail an autologous transplant, that is, if you don't achieve a complete response, or if you relapse after an autologous transplant, or if you're one of the groups that either doesn't respond to that upfront therapy or doesn't respond to salvage, then, as I noted before, you have, you know, probably no more than a 20 to 30% chance of responding at all to the next line of therapy meaningfully. And again, you know, far fewer than 10% of those patients will achieve a CR and have a shot at cure. So that's really the role for CAR T cell therapy. Many of the patients on the original trials that actually had an autologous transplant that we would hope would be curable but relapsed. So the nice thing about this is that the amount of prior failures to therapy don't really seem to be a bar. And as we talked about, I think before, that you know, you can be older, you can be in kind of bad shape. And although these are toxic therapies, we know that patients can respond. So I think that that's the role. Patients who have failed two or prior therapies or have refractory disease, these are the patients who can be cured with CAR T cell therapies. I think the only thing, of course, we have such extraordinary optimism, but I think for, you know, to be a little bit of a glass half full person, we're curing probably about 40% of patients who get CAR T cells. And while that's fantastic, you know, those are patients who might, again, have had a 5%-ish chance of cure. It doesn't make Dr. Neelapur or me happy when we have one of these patients and they get a CR and they do progress again. So it just shows that we have further go. And I think really critically, there are multiple novel agents, either targeting sometimes new multiple surface targets in addition to CD19. There are different constructs that are aimed at causing less CRS. So there are a number of different ways of kind of doing better engineering of these T-cell products to get better responses or to modify their toxicities. And these are all really critical advances that we hope will take that 40% cure and make it 70 or 80% would be great in the next several years.
So Sattva, this is a slide you put together for the talk that you did that we're going to be posting. talking about three preparations that have been evaluated quite a bit, two of which are approved. Can you kind of provide an overview of this?
Sure. So there are three registration trials that have been completed with CD19 CAR T cells in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. You can see here the ZUMA-1, the JULIET study, and the TRANSCEND study. And these three trials use three different products, which are highlighted there. The main difference being the CD28 co-stimulated domain used on the ZUMA-1 product, whereas the other two had 4-1BB co-stimulated domain. In addition, the TRANSCEND trial, the ratio of the CD4 to CD8 CAR T cells is sort of fixed at 1:1. All of them had similar conditioning therapy with Cy/Flu. All of them had similar histologies. There are some minor differences in terms of the patient population, with the ZUMA-1 having the most refractory patient population compared to the other two trials. But you can see here the manufacturing success is uniformly high at about 95% to 99% of the patients. They were able to manufacture the CAR T product. But if you look at the percentage of patients who are enrolled versus those who actually receive the CAR T product, this was 90% on the ZUMA-1, 78% on the TRANSCEND, and 67% on the JULIET. And that's partly because, as we talked earlier, some of these patients have very highly aggressive disease, and they cannot wait the 3 to 4 week turnaround time that's necessary for manufacturing this autologous CAR T product. And some of that was also by trial design.
You want to comment on the efficacy that's been seen, Sattva?
Yeah, so on the left here, you can see the overall response rate across these three trials is somewhere in the range of 50 to 80%, which is quite remarkable for somebody with a relapsed or refractory large B-cell lymphoma who have failed at least two lines of therapy. When we look at historical data, this number is usually in the 20% range. So getting 50 to 80% is really a breakthrough therapy. And if you look at the complete response rate, that's also about 40 to 60% range. And this shows you the progression-free survival curve on the ZUMA-1 on the left and the JULIET on the right. And what's nice to see here is the plateauing of the PFS curve at around the six-month time points, with very few relapses beyond that. On the ZUMA-1, at 2 years, about 40% of the patients remain progression-free and 35% at 1 year on the JULIET trial. And similar outcomes are also being observed on the TRANSCEND trial. On the left, you can see for all patients. On the right, you can see the different histologies of patients. There are some histologies such as the transformed follicular lymphoma and the primary mediastinal B-cell lymphoma seem to do slightly better than the DLBCL and the high-grade B-cell lymphoma patients.
So we're going to hear about a case in a second, but just maybe you can talk a little bit about the current FDA approvals for these products, Sattva.
Yeah, so there are two products currently FDA approved for lymphoma. One is axicabtagene ciloleucel, tested in the ZUMA-1 trial, and the second is tisagenlecleucel, tested in the JULIET trial. Both are approved for adult patients with relapsed or refractory large B-cell lymphoma above the age of 18 years after at least two or more lines of systemic therapy. And both are indicated for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, high-grade B-cell lymphoma, and transformed follicular lymphoma. And in addition, the axicabtagene ciloleucel, or axi-cel in short, is also approved for primary mediastinal B-cell lymphoma.
So, you know, it's always difficult, Krishna, to compare between trials. Unless you compare something head-to-head, it's kind of hard to compare. And we hear now that we have two approved and another preparation that we're seeing some positive results. What's the difference between these products, Krishna, both in terms of their efficacy and as well as their toxicity profiles? Is there a way to compare them, Krishna?
Not easily. We actually have three large randomized trials that are looking at earlier lines of therapy, that are looking at patients who have relapsed head-to-head with autologous transplant. And while they're not comparing each other, eventually we'll actually see how these three trials stack up. The other thing that's different about these ongoing trials is that they're typically using similar systems to look at grading and reporting of toxicities, again, like using this ASTCT grading system. I think we do know some things, even though I would hesitate that there are differences. You know, the differences between these trials include differences in the type of chemotherapy administered beforehand, whether they allowed bridging therapy, inclusion criteria, in some cases, some subtle differences in, you know, which kind of patients got treated. But we do know that Tisagen Leclocel and lisocaptagene or lisocel use a different co-stimulatory domain, as we were told. That's kind of a second signal. Imagine like you go to a web page, you can't get into the web page without entering a password. Well, T cells need a second signal to get activated. And the second signal that tisocel and lisocel have is different than axicell. Axicaptagene cell uses a CD28 domain, and that basically, it's kind of like it accelerates faster. So if you imagine a Ferrari going from 0 to 60 in a shorter period of time than a Civic, they might both get to the same speed, but they take longer time. So axicell, the cells expand more rapidly. We typically see CRS earlier, and the rates of CRS and neurotoxicity look to be higher, even though we don't have direct comparisons. But this may be a slightly better product for patients with more aggressive disease who can tolerate that higher rate of CRS. So there are some differences. If you take a group of people, even though none of us would be on the record of saying one should be used in this setting, if we have a patient who's older or in poorer shape, we might gravitate toward Tisagen Leclocel. If we have a patient with bulkier disease, we might use Axicell. So there are these things, but I would say this is a dialogue about the risks, and one of the reasons that we want referring oncologists and patients to talk to us and to discuss those options. And as Sattva said, there's also differences in the turnaround time and the likelihood of obtaining a product with axicell. Almost everybody who has a product sent out gets one back. With tisocell and lisocaptagene cell, lucel, the fraction of the patients who actually were enrolled in the studies who got cells back were a little bit lower, and we don't always know exactly, but there are some differences there. So this is really, again, it's like other options. It's like myeloma. When Dr. Munshi sees a patient, there's so many different options, and you know, it really requires, I think, a thoughtful discussion. So it's not simple, but we do have some guidelines.
So we're going to close out talking about ALL, but first we'll do one more case. Also to mention that CAR T has been looked at in other lymphomas, follicular lymphoma, mantle cell lymphoma. If you look in your slide deck, you'll see some information about that. It looks pretty exciting. But let's finish out this discussion of large cell lymphoma and hear about the 79-year-old man, Bettina. Maybe you can specifically just focus on what happened when he got the CAR T therapy, because I really want to focus on management of side effects here. So can you talk about kind of what happened at that point?
Sure. So this is, I will say, one of my favorite CAR T patients probably I've ever taken care of, just because he was a really fun guy. But this older gentleman received CAR T cells and, despite his age and comorbidities, tolerated the whole process actually extremely well. He did have a peak of grade 2 cytokine release syndrome with hypotension and fevers over days 4 and 5, which is pretty average. He received one dose of tocilizumab that actually resolved the CRS entirely for him. During that time period and in the days after, he did note a very mild, slowed speech. His wife also noted this. However, he was overall passing his ICE scores with flying colors. They were 10 out of 10, and he had no specific neurologic deficits. I will say a grade 0 of ICANS, although he did maybe have some underlying neurologic toxicity during this. He also had a C. diff infection during this admission, but did very well, went home about 2 weeks after he got the cell infusion, and really continued to have a very good performance status. I would say he came in with an ECOG of 1 and left with an ECOG of 1, doing very well over 2 years out now.
Yeah, so amazing. Complete response in a situation really where you don't have many options. Let's finish out talking briefly about ALL. This is a less common cancer, but still important to know about. And Christian, maybe you can talk a little bit about sort of generally where we are today in the management of ALL and where CAR T therapy fits in.
First, CAR T cell therapy is only approved for patients under the age of 26. There are ALL patients who are adults, you know, that is older than 26. And unfortunately, patients who are 45 or 55 have a much poorer prognosis. They don't have an 80 or 90% cure rate up front like children do. So sadly, children get leukemia, but the good thing is that most of those patients are cured. As we talked about multiple times, you know, when things go badly, they either relapse after therapy. Historically, the therapy was allogeneic transplant. We do have blinatumomab. We have these therapies that are called BiTEs, things that basically bring T cells close together to a target on a cancer cell, but they're not a T cell themselves. They're not an engineered T cell. We see some of the same toxicities. We can see cytokine release syndrome It's rarely severe. But these therapies are great, and they can really help to bridge patients to get to CAR T-cell therapies, but they don't have the high response rates, which are in the 70 to 90% rate, which we have to CAR T-cells. Again, I would say that the caveat is that even though we can get 70 to 90% of patients who have refractory leukemias into an excellent response with CAR T-cells for ALL, we do see relapses, and unfortunately, under half of those patients are cured. So as Athena said, I think among these groups of patients, the ALL patients tend to have more toxicities. They often have high burden of disease. You have to quickly get them in. This is a description of the Eliana trial, which was a trial that led to the approval of Tisagen Leclucel for pediatric leukemias. The same product that's approved in adult lymphomas, but in pediatric leukemias. And as you can see, the overall remission rate was 83%. The CRs were 63%. And again, just under half of those patients are cured. Other studies have confirmed, again, with a number of products, that we can see response rates of 70 to 90%, which are excellent. This is a picture of Emily Whitehead, who was actually the first patient treated by Steve Grupp at the Children's Hospital of Pennsylvania. Emily has actually become an amazing advocate, and she actually has her own foundation, and she posts on the web every year. That's a picture of her on the upper right when she was 1 year cancer-free. Looks like any other lovely developing child. And the most recent one is just from a few weeks ago, 8 years cancer-free. She actually has her own foundation. That's a picture of her at the White House. It's a little note that Barack Obama wrote, please excuse Emily from school. She was with me. By the way, this picture of a child reminds me of, Bettina said, that guy was a fun guy. It reminds me of the old joke that why did everyone like the mushroom? Because he was a fun guy. It's my favorite mushroom dad joke. But this is Emily, and she was actually on ventilator due to cytokine release syndrome, and she actually had high levels of IL-6 in the group at Penn. Carl June actually had a child treated with tocilizumab for rheumatoid arthritis and used an anti-IL-6 blocker. She dramatically improved. She came out of her CAR T-cell CRS, and she is cured, and she's leading an amazing advocate life. So yeah, I think it's nothing but a transformative advance, as it has been for patients with lymphoma. I think it's a little trickier with ALL. For example, the Pediatric National Cancer Institute is taking many patients who get a CR to an allogeneic transplant because they think that that may lead to more cures. We don't know. We know that there are patients who can be cured with CAR T-cells alone, but there are, in some cases, studies that suggest that maybe CAR T-cells should be used as a bridge to allotransplant. That's certainly not the case for lymphoma. It's been an amazing decade, I think, and we have a lot more progress that we're going to see and a lot more amazing cases. And many of us have seen, not necessarily the young children come back like Emily, but you know, we've gone from the first descriptions of acute leukemia in the 1800s, no effective therapies. For about 150 years, we had no way of curing acute leukemia. And then finally, we had combinations of chemotherapy and transplant. In the 90s, we had 80 to 90% cure rates of children. And now for those patients who fail, we basically had almost nothing to offer. We now have these engineered T-cell therapies. So it's been a remarkable transformation just in my career, and I'm getting older every day, but just to see the change has been really, really gratifying and should give us all hope.
Yeah, I've talked to the Penn people, David Porter, et cetera, about that case with Ellie, and you know, in the middle of the night, there were beepers, I guess, in those days, but anyhow, she was in the ICU just horribly sick, and they were just like, oh my God, what have we done? And you know, here it is 8 years later. Well, anyhow, I want to thank the faculty for joining us tonight. Thank everybody who's dialed in. Have a great evening. Be safe and stay well.